Climate change is an economic story. I mean, what else you gotta say? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 22nd of April. Good to have you along, everybody, on this Earth Day. And that is where we are going to begin with President Biden's big virtual climate summit today. Leaders from 40-some-odd countries making their pledges to fight climate change, including a promise from the White House to cut this country's greenhouse gas emissions at least in half by 2030. That is a big swing. And to get there, part of the Biden administration's plan for a greener future is for the whole of government to be involved, not just a couple of departments and agencies. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says it's going to take a whole of economy approach as well. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams cuts through the sloganeering.
Secretary Yellen and the rest of the Biden administration are arguing that climate change is already a crisis affecting the whole economy, so it needs a whole-of-economy response. Sarah Doherty is with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
If we're constantly hammered by disasters, it's really hard to go to work if your place of employment is underwater. It's unlikely that prices will remain stable if we just keep having huge disasters that disrupt the supply chain.
So the Biden administration says it plans to work with domestic and international governmental agencies, as well as private finance, to better factor in climate-related risks, streamline investments, and coordinate regulations. Professor Isabella Alcaniz teaches the politics of climate change at the University of Maryland. She says the administration is signaling it's
committed to investing in tax credits, in direct government investment, and in other tools across economic sectors.
One of those tools is what the government buys. It has a multi-trillion-dollar budget, much of it spent on stuff for the military or the massive civilian workforce. Jason Bordoff is the co-founding dean at Columbia University's Climate School.
By using the government's procurement power to boost demand for new clean energy technologies, it can help to commercialize them, bring down the costs that then make them more affordable and accessible to everyone else.
But Bordoff says to make those changes last, it will require the whole of government to get on board, including Congress. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, things were moving right along till about 1 or so Eastern when Bloomberg broke the news that the Biden administration is planning a big capital gains tax increase, that is higher taxes, on things like, appreciated stock. Traders and the algorithms that actually run things didn't much care for that. Unconfirmed though the news was, and notwithstanding Republicans in the Senate, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. So let's talk about that whole of economy and climate change thing a little bit, because the whole of the economy is a lot. The slice of it at hand for us right now is trade. Ambassador Katherine Tai has been around trade and trade policy for a good long while now. She's been in office as the U.S. Trade Representative for a little bit more than a month, and she is on the phone. Ambassador, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Kai.
So let's pick up with the theme of Earth Day, climate change, the president's summit, and I want to ask you about a speech you gave, a week or so ago, in which you made it pretty clear that you think trade policy is really, really closely aligned with environmental policy. And I want to ask you how you get that done in a global trade environment where all the incentives are cheaper, faster, and not necessarily environmentally friendly.
Well, you ask an excellent question, which is, you're right. The trade rules that have been handed down to us are ones that incentivize what we call a race to the bottom. Mm-hmm. I think what we're witnessing right now is a real recognition on the part of governments, on the part of stakeholders, even our companies, right, the ones who make the decisions about where they're going to produce, that our system needs to have built into the incentives concern for resilience beyond efficiency, and that our environmental changes and the climate crisis is itself a condition that we need to work through as a resilience concern.
How, though, ma'am, do you incentivize? Let's flip the paradigm, right? The current incentives are for a race to the bottom. How do you incentivize a race to the top, right, where companies are, forget rewarded, but not penalized for doing things that might make a product more expensive or take a little bit more time, when that just ain't the way the global economy works?
I hear you, but I think that is the way the global economy needs to evolve. We need to build in incentives. And when we talk about incentives, we're talking about carrots and sticks. So in some ways, what we need to do is figure out how we need to redevise those carrots, maybe the shape of the carrots when they're applied. We need to look at the sticks in terms of how to enforce. We also want to be taking a look at rules that were devised when our world, frankly, looked and operated differently. And maybe think about where those rules need to be tightened or loosened.
All right, let me tick off another couple of things on my list here. My guess would be that if you went to almost any town in America today and asked 10 people on the street what they thought of trade policy, 9.5 of them would say, oh, you mean tariffs? And I say that because, of course, for the last 4 years in this country, trade policy was tariffs. Obviously, we're speaking about President Trump and his trade war with China and other countries as well. I wonder how you recalibrate the conversation around trade in this economy to some kind of equilibrium, moving away from the Trump doctrine on trade, which was, as you know, isolationist and bilateral at best, but often, as you know, America alone.
Well, let me say this, and I'm someone who really prizes a constructive outlook on life and in policy making.
And yet you've been doing trade policy for 25 years.
And I it's really necessary to stay in this business. But let me put it this way. If we do go out and interview 10 Americans across our country and ask them about trade policy, and they come back with the word and the idea tariffs, that means that Americans are thinking about trade policy and they're thinking about how it affects their lives. And I think that that is a good thing. In my mind, the task that we have before us now is to make the case to America, to our largest economic stakeholders, but also to the individual and community levels, that when we are formulating our trade policies, we have the American worker, who is part of a community, in mind, and that we are formulating policies that we have designed to benefit that regular American.
Super quick, I do have to ask you why the president, for all of his differences with Donald Trump, seems to be aligned with him in keeping our tariffs on Chinese imports in place.
I think that we could have another 30-minute conversation about the U.S. Trade relationship with China.
You know what? I'll tell you what. Actually, we'll book that right now after we get off the phone, because honestly, that's the most important trading relationship on the planet. But anyway, briefly, go on.
What I would say is this, that the U.S.-China trade relationship transcends multiple administrations and in any particular one outlook. Regardless of whose administration would have been in charge in the years 2017 to 2021, the U.S.-China trade relationship had been on track to take a significant turn. And you are right in terms of how consequential the relationship is and how consequential it will be for us to get right how we navigate this relationship.
Last thing, ma'am, and then I'll let you go. I want to go back to that speech from a week or so ago that you gave about trade policy and environmental policy. And one of the things you said was, my job is to push for trade reforms that translate into meaningful change in the lives of farmers, ranchers, factory workers, parents, and children, not just in the United States, but around the world. And I wonder whether you thought twice before you wrote that and you said that, because to some in this country, that's going to clang a little bit.
Really? Why is that?
Well, I think at this moment where we are a deeply polarized society, the idea that the United States trade representative would be worrying about workers, farmers, children, and students in countries other than the United States might be problematic for some.
We don't exist in a vacuum. All you need to do is take a look at a map. We are all inextricably linked to each other, and we are sharing this planet as a home. In terms of climate and COVID-19, these are collective challenges, and we only get through them if we can get through it collectively.
Ambassador Katherine Tai is the United States Trade Representative. Ambassador, thanks very much for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Kai.
Global soccer and the money people want to make off of it has been the sports story so far this week, the collapse of the Super League. Stand by, though, because high school basketball is making a play. Overtime Sports, which is a media company that got its start posting high school basketball highlights on social media, says it has just raised $80 million in a funding round with investors like Jeff Bezos and Drake and a bunch of stars from the NBA. Company's going to use some of that money to launch a high school basketball league for kids who want to skip college and start getting paid to play right away. So we sent Marketplace's Andy Ulerov today to explain why investors are so bullish on a new sports media idea.
Overtime Sports claims 1.5 billion views per month on YouTube, Facebook, Snapchat, and other platforms, 40 million followers, and an audience that's 88% under the age of 35. And it's that last number that's arguably the most important to investors. Michael Goldman teaches sports management at the University of San Francisco.
I think that has to do with trying to identify the superstars earlier. And it's also, I think, a recognition that athleticism that's happening younger.
He says when Overtime decided to go after another round of funding, it also helped that the group already had the financial support of Kevin Durant, Carmelo Anthony, and other NBA stars before asking for cash from people like Jeff Bezos. Dan Porter is Overtime's CEO. He says the company's business model speaks to a sort of blending of live sports and social media, something that young fans gravitate toward.
So I can show something that happens on or off the field or on or off the court. And nobody's like, why'd you post that? That didn't happen on the court.
But veteran basketball writer Tommy Beer says creating a sports media company is one thing. Starting a professional league that will have to compete with the NCAA and NBA is another. Because he says there are so many other expenses to factor in.
The staff and the infrastructure to run a successful league, the referees and things that, you know, we kind of take for granted. I'd be surprised if it is, you know, overly successful.
Overtime is creating a new league in part so it has more things to highlight. But David Barry at Southern Utah University is skeptical.
There is a finite amount of time in a day. And if you are watching the coverage from this site, then you're not going to another site.
After all, every one of those sites is fighting for the same eyeballs. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I am no closer to any answers.
No, me neither. Me neither. First, though, let's do the numbers. Major indices all down about 0.9% today. Dow Industrials down 321 points wise, 33,815. NASDAQ down 131 points, 13,818. The S&P 500 retreated 38 points, 41.34. Some new housing numbers today. $329,100 is the new median price for existing homes in this economy. That is a record high. Those prices combined with limited supply, of which our Amy Scott has been telling us, are dragging down sales of existing homes. National Association of Realtors says sales dropped 3.7% from February to March. Tomorrow we get some fresh data on new home sales, thus checking how home builders did on Wall Street today. KB Home shaved off 1.3%. Lennar declined 1.2%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hey, we haven't talked inflation in a couple of days, about which, to be clear, there still isn't a whole lot on a sustained basis. That sustained thing is important. But we are starting to see some price increases on the input side of the price equation, construction in particular. Sabri told us earlier this week about lumber. and why it's so expensive. Today, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports on sharply rising prices for all kinds of raw materials in the construction trades.
It's not just lumber, up 200% year over year, says economist Robert Dietz at the National Association of Home Builders.
Just about all input prices are rising right now in the construction industry.
Diesel's up 80%. Milled copper and brass up 44%.
It's all the literally nuts and bolts. We're hearing about delays or shortages or price increases from gypsum that goes into drywall, steel brackets to help lay down the concrete foundations for homes.
What's driving all this?
Stressed supply chains, particularly at the global level, and just the very hot housing market that desperately needs additional supply.
Rising costs could hamper the recovery for commercial contractors and their clients, developers and government agencies that order up new buildings, says Chris Lingiza at construction management software firm Procore.
Does this make financial sense anymore for me to do this project? Maybe I need to scale it back. Maybe I need to not do it at all.
Builders of homes generally shift higher construction costs onto buyers. Lumber inflation alone has added $24,000 to the price of a new home. Lawrence Yoon is with the National Association of Realtors.
The affordability hurt will be with the first-time buyers, where they have to save up for down payment from their paycheck,
which buys less and less house every month. The median price of an existing home just topped $329,000, the highest ever. A new home will set you back about $20,000 more. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There are, in this economy, the U.S. Department of Agriculture says, 12 million kids who are what's called food insecure. And that's why it was a big deal when the USDA announced that it's going to extend its universal free lunch program through the end of the 2021-22 school year, so more than another 12 months. As Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, those meals and not having to pay for them has been critical in this pandemic.
Like a lot of school districts, Littleton Public Schools south of Denver has had just about every permutation of schooling this year: remote, hybrid, in-person. And that affected students who got two meals a day at school. Jessica Gold is the district's director of nutrition.
We had bus routes going throughout our district, and we were providing meals to students that way. We have had different nightly pickups.
Because of temporary policy changes made by the USDA at the beginning of the pandemic, free meals have been provided to all children, sometimes even in bulk. Gold says that's helped because there are more students in need. Still, the district ended up feeding fewer students overall than when all schooling was in person. Diane Pratt-Hefner is with the School Nutrition Association.
Families often have transportation or scheduling challenges in terms of getting to meal pickup.
But the costs have gone up. In the past year, Littleton Public Schools has spent nearly $74,000 more on packaging. Higher costs and fewer meals are a reality for districts everywhere, says Pratt-Hefner. And early attempts at getting food to remote students have had to change, like using those school buses to deliver meals.
Some of those efforts were limited by students returning to schools, and those buses suddenly needed to be used to transport the students instead of the meals.
And that's another reality facing school districts.
Many more children are actually going to be in school all the time in the fall than they are now.
That's Lauren Bauer, an economist at the Brookings Institution. She says the impact of universal free lunch may be bigger next school year. And knowing that meals will be provided free of charge may be one bit of certainty that will allow school districts to plan ahead. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Something like 30 million Americans, slightly more actually, have had COVID and survived. That's according to the CDC. For some not small fraction of those people, though, things are not completely back to normal. Estimates vary, but it's possible that as many as 80% of patients still have symptoms 3 months after they first got sick. And that is even after tests no longer detect the virus in them. And those symptoms could be fatigue, could be heart problems, could be worse. Right. And that many people getting that sick for that long, and obviously they can't go back to work, means, as Marketplace's Jasmine Garz reports, our disability system is going to have to adapt.
Over a year after getting COVID-19, Diana Berendt continues to be mystified by some of her symptoms. Headaches, deep inner ear pain.
I've had so many MRIs and CAT scans and so on and so forth, and I am no closer to any answers.
Berendt says she's lucky. She has insurance. Around 30 million Americans don't. Berendt founded Survivor Corps, an organization that supports COVID-19 survivors. She says they have about 165,000 members.
And so many of them are people in their 20s and 30s who are fitness instructors, college athletes, and 6 months after a mild case of COVID are in wheelchairs and on feeding tubes. Like, this is not a post-viral malaise.
Congress has allotted $1.15 billion for the National Institutes of Health to study long COVID. How many people have it and why? Several states have also funded initiatives. New York City has its own aftercare program, which Dr. Amanda Johnson oversees. She estimates about 10% of COVID patients are long haulers. And overwhelmingly, they're worried about money.
When they're going to be able to get back to work, people are concerned about advocating for themselves to have some type of graduated set of responsibilities, being able to take breaks, being able to access paid sick leave, whether they should retire.
Especially, she says, since a lot of them are in essential jobs, we're asking for more flexible workloads, not an option. And going on disability is also a long shot. This is something that worries Rebecca Vallis at the Century Foundation.
COVID long haulers appear to represent the largest influx of new entrants to the American disability community that we've seen in modern history.
Vallis herself used to be a disabilities lawyer. She describes applying for disability as a process that might as well require a law degree.
Unfortunately for the influx of COVID long haulers, our federal disability system is designed to deny people.
In 2019, more than 60% of disabilities applicants were denied. And those who get it, Vallis adds, have to wait 5 months before the assistance kicks in. Disability rights lawyer Eve Hill is one of the lead organizers on the Stop the Wait Act, which would shorten the time between people being approved for assistance and receiving it. She's hoping the act gets reintroduced by this Congress.
Well, many, many, many people die during the wait. Many, many, many people go bankrupt during the wait, and many people become so poor during the wait that they go on SSI, the income-based support system.
Hill says making the disabilities system easier for long haulers to navigate is key to the American economic recovery.
So if we want people to be able to get back to work when they're able to get back to work, we are shooting ourselves in the foot.
Diana Berendt of Survivor Corps points out that some of the major changes in disability rights in America came after World War II. The number of returning soldiers, many disabled, made it clear there needed to be an organized national approach. She sees a parallel with long COVID.
We're talking about people who've been maimed essentially by this virus in a very short time span.
Many advocates say this pandemic has been like a war, one that many people are still fighting. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, just to put an economic punctuation mark on the climate change Earth Day story. There's a report out today from Swiss Re, which is an insurance company that provides insurance to insurance companies. Reinsurance, it's called, which is a whole nother story. But anyway, their research shows that a warming planet is going to cut 11 to 14% off global output by 2050, compared with what it would be without climate change. Global output, of course, in plain English, is economic activity, which means maybe $23 trillion in lower output worldwide every year because of climate change. All right, we got to go, but here is your moment of economic context, partisan political dithering with the full faith and credit of the United States edition. Congressional Republicans came out with their counter to President Biden's infrastructure plan today, $568 billion over 5 years. The White House wants to spend $2.3 trillion over 8, but that's not why I bring it up. I bring it up because the GOP is threatening once again not to approve an extension of the U.S. debt limit when it comes due at the end of July. This is by no means the last of this story on this program or elsewhere. So when you hear of it again, and you will, remember that the debt limit and the associated threat of defaulting on our debt is about money that's already spent. It's not new borrowing. That's important. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Beth Perlman, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.